Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. This is your host, E. Marcel Portute. It's been a while since I've talked to all of you out there. Hope everything's been going well for you out there in the world. As always, you can follow us on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word, on Facebook under The Sports Inquirer, and finally, subscribe to our show on iTunes under The Sports Inquirer. Support friends to The Inquirer as well. We've actually grown our network a little bit, so go to these websites and show them some love. Go to Atlanta Voice, a really good site there, some positivity about some good content in the city of Atlanta. TheSportsJock.com, a good site as well. They do a weekly show on Monday mornings from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., so go to that site. And finally, TheStartingLineup.net, as always, really good content. And they do a weekly show on Saturdays about the world of Chicago sports. We're going to take our first break, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into our edition of the Backdoor Cut. But instead of the NBA version, we're going to do an NCAA tournament version of the Backdoor Cut, because, of course, we are in the middle of March Madness, and in a few hours, the Sweet 16 is going to be in full effect. So we're going to take a break, and when I come back, I'm going to review the picks that I made for the Sweet 16 and also delve into the debate of the coverage of senior college basketball players in comparison to freshmen. So we're going to delve into that as well here on the podcast. Welcome back to the show. What we're going to do now is delve into each region and my thoughts on the round of 64 and round of 32 matchups, and then give you my predictions for what's going to happen this weekend. So we'll start off in the South. Interesting bracket here. Florida and UCLA did pretty much what I expected them to do. Of course, Kyle Rowell disappointed me in that 8-9 matchup. They didn't even show up. That was going to be one of my upset picks, my special. And 77-48, the Buffaloes lose to Pittsburgh. Very disappointed in that performance. And on the other side of the bracket, I had Dayton over Ohio State. We're going to delve into the Ohio State situation in a little bit. But respect to Dayton getting major wins over Ohio State and Syracuse and route to their first Sweet 16 in, I think, over 20 years. But I did not have Dayton losing to Syracuse. Syracuse is a very disappointing finish to a season that had them starting, I believe, 22-0. When you go 0-for from the three-point line, I believe they're 0-for 12 from three-pointers, you're not going to win those games. And the fact that they only lost that contest to Dayton 55-53 is pretty impressive and indicative of the solid defense that Syracuse plays, but you have to make open shots. And another disappointing team was Kansas, losing to Stanford 60-57. We should have seen this coming a little bit because, first of all, the Joel Embiid injury, the star center for the Jayhawks, him being injured was a major factor for them. But when you have a team like Stanford, a veteran group, a set of guys, and that's what we're starting to see in a lot of these brackets where teams like Dayton and a few others will delve into, they actually have players who have stuck around on campus for 2-3 years and have built that chemistry and developed a camaraderie of playing together. And that's really coming through in some of these matchups. For Kansas, you had Embiid out, and Andrew Wiggins trying to get him involved. He had a really rough game against Stanford himself. When you have so many moving parts and trying to bring them together, it's very difficult. And that way you have to give respect to another team that we're going to get into a little bit later as well, of being able to bring all of these pieces together and play well. But Kansas, that was a disappointing loss to Stanford. Stanford is a solid team, but should not beat Kansas in that scenario. So now we have the Sweet 16. We have Florida against UCLA. The Bruins, under the radar, may have had the two most impressive wins in the tournament. They've been solid, and Wisconsin's been another team that's quietly been the most impressive teams. Of course, we talked about Louisville and Kentucky and Florida and Arizona, teams who are national title contenders. But as far as impressive performances, I would put UCLA's wins over Tulsa and Stephen F. Austin against anybody's. Granted, the level of competition may not be as high as those other contemporary teams, but UCLA going against Florida, I still have the Gators winning that contest. The Gators are coming out of this region in my analysis. I just like the way Florida plays with their four starters as seniors, the units that's played together. Billy Donovan, maybe the best coach out there, so I know they're going to do really well. Dayton versus Stanford in the other half of that bracket in the Sweet 16, obviously a coin flip, no clue. I guess I'll go with Stanford. I think they'll be a little too physical for Dayton. Stanford has some big guys inside that can really give them a tough run. So Florida against Stanford, and I'm picking the Gators. Either whoever wins between Dayton and Stanford, the Gators are going to win that contest. We're going to move over to the West. In a region that's gone pretty chalk, Arizona and San Diego State have come out of the top half of the bracket. Arizona's has rolled past Weber State and Gonzaga. You kind of expected that to happen. My North Dakota State, I wanted them to go, I had them going to the Sweet 16, and they were in it for a little bit against San Diego State, but in the end, the Aztecs were too much for them. That's going to be a really good matchup, Arizona and San Diego State and Anaheim. That matchup, Anaheim is obviously close to San Diego, but Arizona obviously has a big contingent as well. That's going to be a split crowd. Wildcats should pull that out. And the other side, we have Baylor and Wisconsin. Baylor is one of those teams, this is the best they've performed all season as far as getting everyone together. That Creighton game was scary. Now, granted, Creighton, while we love Doug McDermott, another senior player who has received a lot of attention this year, I thought Creighton was very limited overall as far as offensively outside of him, and Baylor just put it on them and dominated that contest. And Wisconsin, once again, Bo Ryan doing a great job in Madison. Not the normal Wisconsin team where strong emphasis on defense and running the picket fence and a lot of motion offense. This may be the best offensive unit he's had there, maybe since Devin Harris was there several years ago. Defensively, they're not as efficient, but this is still a dangerous team that I think can go further in the tournament than other teams he's had there in the past. And there, Wisconsin is facing Baylor. I'm going to ride the hot hand and take the Baylor Bears to win that contest and face Arizona. And in the end, Arizona is going to go to the Final Four there. So far, I have two number one seeds, and it's very rare we get four number one seeds into the we're not going to get four number one seeds into the Final Four this year, because we're going to move on to the Midwest and probably the most intriguing Sweet 16 matchups and the most intriguing bracket that we've seen overall. Kentucky, the big win over Wichita State in the round of 32. I put on my Twitter and Facebook as well, and I'm trying to remember the exact words. I put Wichita State lost frauds from the start. You would have thought I kicked someone's baby or hit someone's dog when I said that. I got several responses. Wichita State's not a fraud. They were undefeated. They earned that number one seed, and breaking down all of their statistics. What I meant was is that Wichita State, yes, they did earn their number one seed. They did a very good job of going undefeated. If you go undefeated in anything, whether it's rec league, NBA, whatever, that's you earn respect for that. They did deserve the number one seed. I just did not think they were national title contenders. So when I said they were frauds, I didn't say they were fraud as a team. I meant as a national title contender. And I guess I should have been more specific on that when I put out the tweet. And of course, that's an example of being careful what you put on social media and people not completely grasping what you're trying to say. Kentucky with the Harrison twins, with the Julian Randle, that is the best they've played all season in that 78-76 win over Wichita State. They're going to face Louisville, who for a defending national champion have flown under the radar, relatively speaking. And when I say relatively speaking, because it's still a Rick Pitino team, Louisville is a blue-collar not blue collar, a blue chip program in college athletics and all sports, but especially in men's basketball. So they're going to get attention. But that matchup on tomorrow night is going to be amazing between Kentucky and Louisville. I have Louisville in my Final Four. We're going to stick with Louisville. But if Kentucky wins that contest, those teams are very familiar with each other. It would not surprise me to see the Wildcats pull that one out. And the other half of the bracket, big win for Mercer. Being here in Atlanta, the Mercer Bears got a lot of attention for that outstanding victory over Duke. They ended up falling to Tennessee, though, a team that Martin, the head coach, was going to be fired about 2-3 weeks ago, if you were hearing reports and getting the perception of the fans, and now he gets a reprieve. Now he's the best coach out there. We don't need Bruce Pearl to come back to Knoxville. And they got their path, they beat UMass and Mercer. And now Tennessee is back on the good graces of their fans and the media. And that shows you also how a bracket setup can happen, where you'll get a situation where some of these teams have to go through major competition just to get to a Sweet 16, while some brackets just open up. If Tennessee had to face, say, Duke in that round of 32 game, I highly doubt the Volunteers would win that contest. But since they got Mercer, no disrespect to the Bears, I've saw them play several times here in Kennesaw or the Atlanta area, working with Kennesaw State in the Atlantic Sun. Duke is a better team than Mercer 95% of the time. But that one contest, respect to Mercer, they got the win. Tennessee had an easier road to get to this round than some other teams, like, say, a Michigan, who had to beat a pretty solid Wofford team and then get past Texas just to get to this level. And speaking of Michigan, that's where they're at. Michigan and Tennessee are going to face each other in the round of 16. And that's where I have Michigan coming through as well in that contest. And that's where you get, I think, Louisville and Michigan in that round, and that's where Louisville returns to the Final Four. A Louisville team that I thought was underseeded from the beginning. They really should have been a 2-seed. You could have made a case that they possibly could have been a 1-seed if some other circumstances happened, but that's where I have the Cardinals coming out of that. And then finally, moving over to the East, a team I have shown minimal respect to. I have them in my Sweet 16, but the Virginia Cavaliers. Talk about a team flying under the radar. And the job that Tony Bennett's done there. ACC regular season champions, tournament champions, and a number one seed. I don't think I've seen one team. I saw one rider, I think, put Virginia in the Final Four. And I don't have them in the Final Four, but they've done a really good job of getting to Sweet 16. They're facing Michigan State, who's a media darling. I've seen several people pick the Spartans to make it to the Final Four, especially with the play of Payne, the center, who has maybe been the most valuable player or most important player. I think they have most outstanding player, the MOP. That's why they have a little wrinkle to the MVP aspect when the tournament finishes up, the most outstanding player. Payne would have to be right up there for Michigan State. He's had a dominating performances against Delaware and Michigan State, the outstanding center for the Spartans. So Virginia and Michigan State are going to go at it. I have the Spartans winning that contest. I gave so much respect to the laurels of the Cavaliers, but Michigan State's going to win that contest with their physicality. And the other side, Iowa State, who I actually have coming out of this bracket, tough injury to their center, but they have rolled through as well, beating North Carolina Central and North Carolina. And they're going to face Connecticut, another blue chip program that's been pretty quiet. And Connecticut's gotten past Milwaukee and Villanova. So we have Iowa State and Connecticut. I'm still going to stick with the Cyclones to not only beat Connecticut, but beat Michigan State and reach their, I think, their first Final Four, maybe ever. So those are my thoughts on the NCAA brackets. And what I wanted to go into a little bit more as well is portrayal of senior college basketball players versus the freshmen. I saw this, I believe, with, I want to say, Luke Wynn, who writes for Sports Illustrated, does a very good job, or Seth Davis, one of them, who does work with CBS, and they were trying to really promote the laurels of the senior college basketball player in comparison to the freshman. And I think what really sparked this was the negativity towards Aaron Kraft, the outstanding senior point guard for Ohio State, and he had They were facing Michigan in the semifinals of the Big Ten tournament. They were down by one. He drove down the court, and when he was going up for the shot, he lost the ball and wasn't not able to get a shot off, and they lost to Michigan. And there was a lot of negativity towards Aaron Kraft, how he can't play, how he can't shoot, struggles with dribbling, a lot of other things. Yet, in comparison to the media attention he gets, the barks of him being overrated. Respect to Aaron Kraft and Doug McDermott, Sean Kilpatrick at Cincinnati, and some other seniors. But the reality is that college basketball has turned into a feeder for the NBA and is viewed as such. The more interesting players in college basketball that not only casual fans follow, but I think the majority of even the hardcore college followers are the freshmen and the better pro prospects, like Jabari Parker, Andrew Wiggins, Aaron Gordon, even Tyler Ennis, the point guard out of Syracuse. If you need proof, look at the media coverage. You'll see more followers of, especially this time of year. The advantage that college football has over college basketball is that we get to see the players for at least 2 years if they redshirt 1 year. And if they play through all three seasons, we get to see the view of them from that way. We've seen Javion Clowney play for three seasons at South Carolina. We've seen the positives and the negatives. Blake Bortles at Central Florida. We've seen him play and start for three seasons. With college basketball, with the way the system is structured, where you have to go to college for only one season and then go to the NBA, that puts more of an onus on looking at the future players in a shorter amount of time. And that's where you have more attention towards a Jabari Parker and towards Andrew Wiggins. Now, if I was picking a team as far as playing in college game, I'd probably take Doug McDermott over Parker and Wiggins. When it comes to the NBA and projecting 2-3 years from now, I would take the freshmen currently over some of the seniors. That doesn't mean that the seniors aren't valuable players. I think the reality is that we look at all college sports as a projector for what we're going to see in the future. And that's where guys like Seth Davis, Luke Wynn, Pat Forty, they'll hold on to that senior ideal, but the reality has changed. The way this can really be changed, I think, is that if you look at the rule as far as eligibility for the NBA draft, they should just go to the college baseball system, and that would solve all problems. Legally, they shouldn't have the right to deny a player an opportunity to play in a professional league, I don't think. But if they go by the college baseball standard, you can either choose to go straight to the draft out of high school. But if you do commit to college, you have to sign and play for 3 years. And I think that's what the ultimate solution should be. It's the best of both worlds. You have the guys who have no interest in playing college athletics. They can go straight to the NBA, play professional, do what they got to do. And then you have some guys who want to go to college. They can enjoy that experience as well. But the fact that you look at the current state of college basketball, it's become a in-between. CBS, who does a very good job of, and TBS now, it's the Turner family, they do a very good job of the college basketball coverage. But look who they have on their panel. You see Steve Smith, Grant Hill, and of course Kenny Smith and Charles Barkley. And Ernie Johnson to a lesser extent. Not lesser extent as far as the analysis side of things. But those are all people who have made their trade in covering the NBA. And that's where I think the media coverage is starting to realize that, is that we would like to see the college players from the eyes of the NBA. And that's just a reality that a lot of these writers who focus strictly on college, or the majority of the coverage is on college, is what they're going to have to deal with. They're going to have to accept the reality of certain people just watching the NCAA tournament and not watching all of the contests back in November and December, and really appreciating some of the upperclassmen players. And then you have to look at guys who are really looking strictly as an analysis for the future of their pro careers. As I said, Aaron Kraft had an outstanding career for Ohio State. They took them to one Final Four, multiple Big Ten championships, starter for all 4 years. There's no shame in that. But if you're critiquing his game, as far if you're looking from a scope of how most people look at it, including myself, you look at him as a player that's going to really struggle at the next level. Now, I have the ability to separate the difference between looking at the scope from a college perspective and then a pro perspective, but a lot of people don't do that. And that's where they're just going to have to accept the reality of that situation. All right, we're going to take our first another break here, and when we come back, we're going to delve into the Atlanta Hawks and their dealings in the past few games here on the podcast. Welcome back to the show here on the podcast. D. Marcel Portute, as always. Hawk, rough 24 hours or 48 hours for the Atlanta Hawks. I went to the contest against Phoenix that they had over at Phillips Arena. And we're going to get into the we're going to play the audio of Coach Bud's press conference after that contest. And it was a rough game for them. They lost 102-95 to the Phoenix Suns. And they also lost last night to the Minnesota Timberwolves. But let's play the audio from Tuesday night's performance against the that contest was on Monday. So they've actually had a rough 3 days with the Hawks. Let's play his audio and his thoughts on the game. And once that's done, I'll delve into the Phoenix game and what I saw there and some analysis as well of the Minnesota contest.
It's always one of those things where you gotta go back and look at the film. I think, a few guys made some shots. Channing Frye, I felt like Channing Frye was making shots the whole game. Driving shots to the paint, especially late, to finish the quarter. I think just everybody that contributed. Joe Green, I think, was more in the fourth quarter than he got going. But the third quarter, honestly couldn't pinpoint what led to their 35 points. I'm sure there were. I'm sure even in the quarter when we held them 17-9 all time defensive back then. I think, their guards started getting inside of us, and that ultimately becomes a problem. That would happen in the third quarter with the penetration, and our guards getting inside of us. Yeah, no, I thought that was one of the positives from tonight. We had a good bounce. We played, I think, decisively. We did work to use. He really helped us. Helped us a lot in the first half. And there were stretches where we were hanging in the second half. We did play that, so that's a real positive.
Yeah, I think
first quarter, we had a good defensive play. They just got away from us in transition. Bravo got the one in front of their bench. And then I think it was Bravo that went in trail in transition. They put a lot of pressure on you early in the clock and put pressure on you to get matched up. I think one of the threes in the first quarter was out of a good middle situation. It was a great pass, a good shot. But there's two or three in transition and one was coming out to me. They want to be the most difficult, but you want to be the good thing like that. That's where you can put a lot of energy in after the championship.
All right, folks, that was Coach Budenhoser from the Atlanta Hawks head coach after their loss on Monday night to the Phoenix Suns, 102-95. Thoughts on this contest? Atlanta started off really well, I thought, in the first quarter. Phoenix is an interesting team, and we're going to delve into the Suns quite a bit in a minute, but I thought they did well in the first half. They were able to stay in the contest. Phoenix, very aggressive offensively, especially with Gordon Dragic and Eric Bledsoe, two point guards who are on the court a bit, quite together. The Hawks' struggles this season have come in several forms. One way is perimeter defense. Dragic and Bledsoe were able to drive at will into the lane and get a lot of open three-pointers for Channing Frye and even Markieff Morris. And that's where they really struggled as far as defending that. Channing Frye had about three or four open three-pointers in the contest where no one was near him. And that was a big concern for the defensive perimeter play, especially in the third quarter, where the Suns outscored the Hawks 35-23, and that's really where the difference in the game came. And if you look at three-pointers overall, Phoenix shot 12-24, 50% from three-pointers, while Atlanta was 8-23. In that type of contest, I think Atlanta may have took too many three-pointers. If you look at Damari Carroll, he had 4 three-point attempts. Peril Antic, he has 4 three-pointers. I think attempts. Paul Millsap, he even had 2 three-pointers. In that type of contest, the Atlanta Hawks had the advantage physicality inside where they could have taken advantage of their bulk. And the offensive sets, and having Kyle Korver out is a major factor for the Atlanta offense. Korver, who is one of those guys where if he was on a championship caliber team, I think he would get more respect on a national level. He hits his three-pointers, he runs through screens excellently, and the Hawks have really struggled with their offensive flow since he's been out with some back issues. And what you saw the Suns do is just really push the pace of the contest throughout. The Bledsoe had a game-high 20 points, Dragic had 19 points himself and 6 assists. When I do my MVP voting at the end of this season, and the NBA season really only has about 3 weeks left, Dragic is going to make my top 10. I don't know if he'll crack my top 5, but what he has done for that franchise and getting them to a postseason position has been remarkable. Bledsoe was fun to watch up close and personal because he may be one of the most selfish players I've seen in the NBA in a long time, in a good way. We critique players such as Russell Westbrook for their selfishness
and taking more shots at Kevin Durant like we've done on here on the show. But it's done in an aggressive way where it doesn't seem like the teammates like it. With Bledsoe, it seemed like he could have taken 23 straight shots and the teammates would have been okay with it. The Phoenix chemistry was very strong overall with that, and it's a really balanced attack. You also had other double-digit scorers. Markieff Morris, as I said, he has 17. Gerald Green, 13 points, 4 of 6 from the field overall. Very solid bench player for them. Revitalized his career as well. He was known mostly as a guy who threw some good dunks and has some athleticism, but he's turned into a solid, complete player with the Suns. And then Channing Frye, a man who you should not leave wide open for a jumper. He was 4 of 9 from 3-point land, and he had 18 points and seven rebounds as well. He actually got in the paint and got some good rebounds for the Suns. They're an interesting setup over there with Phoenix. As far as Atlanta goes, Paul Millsap, 19 points. Let's see, he had 5 rebounds, 5 turnovers. That's something that you can't have happen. Actually, he had 3 turnovers, but still, he handled the ball way too much in the perimeter, and that's where you can't have that happening with him. And so Damari Carroll, 19 points. Jeff Teague, 17 points in the contest. Lou Williams was, and Coach Bud talked about that in the press conference you just heard, was a solid contributor off the bench and tried to step up his offense with the absence of Kyle Korver. If Lou Williams and Jeff T can get on the same page as far as being on the court, that would be a really good situation for Atlanta. And they lost last night as well to Minnesota, and that fourth quarter was ugly. You had Ricky Rubio just running at will, throwing lobs to Kevin Love. Really tough stretch for Atlanta right now, because tonight they have the Portland Trailblazers, and Saturday night they go to Washington. So if they lose those two contests, you could be looking at a 4-game losing streak. And while they're still in position to make the playoffs, which unfortunately is a sad state of the East, the Knicks have not made enough headway to make it a situation where they can make an impact. So unless Atlanta completely implodes, which I don't think they will, they're going to be in the playoffs. But you like to have more positivity heading into the postseason. So those are my thoughts on the Atlanta Hawks. I'll be there tonight against the Portland Trailblazers, and I'll get some more audio for you there as well. When we come back, we're going to delve into the latest edition of Verbal Submission, MMA version, and we'll be UFC focused. But when we come back, as I said, Verbal Submission, our MMA mixed martial arts segment here on the podcast. If I ever have a kid and have a son, his name might be Hendo. That was an outstanding performance by Dan Henderson against Shogun Hua at the latest UFC fight night that took place this past Sunday. Should have been Saturday, but it was Sunday because it was in Brazil and some scheduling situations over in Brazil. But anyway, he was losing the first two rounds of that contest against Shogun Hua. Multiple times, he looked like he was going to be knocked out. That fight could have been stopped in the first round. Herb Dean deserves a lot of credit for letting that fight continue in that first round. Personally, I would have not been completely mad if if the Herb Dean, the referee, stopped that contest and gave the victory to Hua. Dean is obviously a veteran referee against, and he sat two veterans who I believe, I'm pretty sure he's been in the cage with multiple times. So he was able to gauge their effectiveness and gauge if Henderson was able to defend himself. But I would not have complained about an early stoppage if that happened. But of course, it did not stop, and we got maybe a top five classic knockout in the history of mixed martial arts. That comeback in the third round was incredibly inspiring, and Henderson, we need to really look when his career is over, and the guy seems timeless. When we look back on his career, he is going to be a top 10 all-timer, maybe even top 5. I mean, if you think about it, Pride champion, Strikeforce champion, has been right up there, right in there in the UFC as far as a title contender, has given us some excellent contests, maybe the greatest fight in MMA history, or on the short list, was him against Hua, their first contest. And obviously this victory giving us one of the seminal moments of the past decade in mixed martial arts. And we all can't forget the Michael Bisping knockout with that right hand, which I think for most Americans was maybe one of the most glorious moments in MMA history. Much respect to him for getting that win. I personally think both guys, obviously they match up well together. I don't see much potential for either one of them as far as being a title contender, which in a way could be okay. We've talked about it ad nauseum here, and we'll get into maybe the deepest division in MMA history in about a minute. We always look at championship fights, and we should, as far as the benchmark for your promotion, for a division, and so forth. But to fill out a full fight card, and that's where the UFC has been very fortunate in that regard, as far as, and boxing really struggles with. In boxing, you have your title fight, whoever it is, and that for an event, and that's really it. You may have an undercard, maybe an up-and-comer, and that's really your entire interest. The beauty of UFC and Bellator as well has done a solid job for their standards. You have every card, maybe four or five fights that you're interested in. If a title bout is involved, even better, of course. We all want to see two fights for a championship. But to have the depth of a roster, depth of a card, you need guys like Shogun and Henderson and a few others to make it more worth the value of you paying for the event or just viewing the event. Both of those guys are still marquee names. You put them on any card, they're either in the main event or be a co-main, or just right up there near the top of the card. As far as me being a fan of the sport and seeing both of these guys fighting since the early 2000s, both of them have a lot of wear on their tires, and I'd like to see them both retire, especially Shogun, who has not looked good in his past few contests, but you still appreciate that moment where you see two veterans going at it, going hard. And that was just an amazing fight overall. And I've never heard a crowd so quiet after such a devastating knockout. You'll hear a quiet crowd if there is a boring fight and maybe a submission. And just kind of give like the polite applause. Oh, he choked him out. He gave him put him in an armbar and whatever. But you could hear literally, you can literally hear maybe one or two people talking out of a crowd that was so boisterous and loud during the entire night for Brazilians. So Henderson shut up an entire nation of fans with that victory. The welterweight division may be the most stacked division in any period in MMA history. A few weeks ago, Johnny Hendricks barely survived over Robbie Lawler at UFC 171. I personally had to fight 2-2 heading into the fifth. And Hendricks got some takedowns, was able to do some, take advantage of being on top, and got that win over Lawler, I think literally in the final 3 minutes to secure the victory. Those two guys joined Tyron Woodley, Carlos Condit, who unfortunately lost to Woodley on that same night due to a knee injury, and it just came out that he had a torn ACL. Very unfortunate news for all of us. Hector Lombard, Rory McDonald, Nick Diaz, all in the UFC welterweight division, I think it's the deepest the division has been in one promotion in history. And that doesn't even include George St. Pierre, who was in a sabbatical or retirement, whatever you want to call it. Pride had a fun run with light heavyweights and heavyweights, if you want to kind of merge them together, in the early 2000s. But the lack of Chuck Liddell, the UFC Hall of Famer, and he was fighting in the UFC during that time frame, the lack of him fighting in Pride really devalues it being as deep as you think it was. The future of the division is very bright. I can see Robbie Lawler maybe getting another rematch, or getting a rematch in the near future. Woodley can fight for the title. Hector Lombard, I've heard some talk for him. I personally was underwhelmed by his victory over Jake Shields. Yes, he got the victory, but I thought he looked very stiff in the stand-up. Now, obviously, he's a physical guy, strong, very tough puncher, solid on the ground, too. But I didn't think he was as overwhelming a victor in that contest as many other people think. But if you put him in a title picture with another victory, sure, I would not be mad at that at all. Rory McDonald looks like he's trying to build his career back up. He'll get back to a rightful place. See, that Lawler fight really messed him up, but he's moving back up in there. Nick Diaz, he's doing his usual talking his shit. I don't think that he is going to be in the title picture right now. I don't think he should be, because he's coming off some losses himself. But once again, if he gets a win or two, it's going to be hard to deny him a potential opportunity for a title shot. And as I said, the George St. Pierre situation, I've said that he was going to come back and fight by, I think, the New Year's, well, I'm going to say Super Bowl weekend 2015 is when he's going to come back and fight. He's not going to just wrap up his career at this stage. He's taking his time off. He's taking care of whatever he needs to on a personal level. He'll be back. And if he comes back and these fighters are at the rate that they are, it without question would be the deepest a division has been in history. Chris Weidman's out for UFC. He's out of his title defense that he was scheduled to face Lyoto Machida in May due to a knee injury. That bout has been moved to July. Man, this is a really rushed return for Weidman. If it was one of the situations where he had to just rest his knee and not have surgery, I think it'd be okay. Give it 6 additional weeks. I can kind of understand that. But they're performing surgery on him. This isn't like a typical, you know, a little scope where, and I don't know what type of knee injury it is. I don't think a word has officially come out as of Thursday morning when I'm recording the show. But that's not a situation where you should come back immediately from. Anytime you hear knee injury and surgery, that to me, I just assume that's 3-4 months. And the way they're making the scene right now is like, oh, he's just going to have a minor procedure. He'll be okay. He'll be back. I'd be very careful if I was Weidman in that case. And that's where you may see the UFC trying to rush him back. Because look at their title fighters. Cain Velasquez, he's out with injury for the majority of this year. Johnny Hendricks, he's going to be out a long time. I think he had a shoulder issue with his fight. And Robbie Lawler, you know when he's coming back. John Jones, he's actually fighting Teixeira pretty soon. But if you look down the line, you have a lot of injuries to their top fighters or known fighters. And Weidman's become a known guy. So they don't want that middleweight champion who hasn't beat Anderson Silva twice and become a household name, at least relative to the MMA world. They don't want him on the shelf for a very long time, which I get. But you have to be very careful trying to come back from a knee injury too soon. If he comes back too soon and re-injures it, or is not at 100%, then you're going to have a wounded fighter for the rest of his career. Personally, I don't see why Vitor Belfort can't come back and get off his TRT, his testosterone replacement therapy. And by that time, by May, you would think that he would be weaned off of it if he has been doing it properly. But, of course, this fight takes place in Las Vegas, and the Nevada Athletic Commission has a drug test on him that we can assume, allegedly, or whatever legalese you want to say, he is going to come back positive from, and that's going to just cause a lot of problems. So you would think that Vitor could come back and fight in that contest against Machida, you know, to fight for, you know, for a main the number one main contender spot. But we're not going to see that contest because Vitor has some of those issues. So those are my thoughts on the world of MMA and verbal submission. When I come back, I'm going to delve more into miscellaneous topics here on the podcast. All right, final segment here on the podcast. E. Marcel Portute, your host. Since we've actually recorded, since my last podcast, wanted to go into the Paralympics. What the Winter Paralympics took place in Sochi since we last did our show. Very inspirational stuff. Was honestly, for a sports fan or a sports follower and a journalist, my knowledge of Paralympics or, you know, or sports with disabled people was very low. But it was very interesting watching this, you know, snowboarding, watching ice hockey, and seeing that the performances in that way, and even the like cross-country skiing and like biathlon with the shooting. Very intrigued by that. It's something that I really would like to get into a little bit more. NBA thoughts, like most of you probably out there, watched that Miami Indiana contest last night. Incredible performances by both teams. What you're starting to see right now is both teams get into playoff form. Those are two of the best teams in the East. As much respect as we have given the Bulls and seeing what Brooklyn has done and Washington, they look like they're going to finally be a postseason team again after a few years off. And Atlanta, of course, we delved into the Hawks. Those are two of the best teams in the East and maybe in all of the NBA. Outstanding competition. We saw LeBron go off for 30-plus points. Wade had his thing going, but not much else from Miami and not much support. When you have Chris Bosh taking multiple three-pointers in the fourth quarter, I don't like that at all. When you have Paul George being able to drive to the basket and get dunks and get to the foul line, that's not good as well. Both of those teams, we're going to have a lot more time to analyze them and give commentary because they're going to face off in the Eastern Conference Finals, and we'll have 2 weeks of high drama in those games. Steve Masiolo won't go to South Florida for lying on his resume about graduating from Kentucky. Manhattan head coach was all set and signed to go to South Florida. However, he lied on his resume about graduating from Kentucky. He attended Kentucky, played there for Rick Pitino, but he did not graduate, therefore he lost his job. Don't understand how in 2014 guys just are not honest about what's going on with their job situations. It's way too easy to find out everything about somebody. I'm not a computer expert. I mean, I have some skills, and I'm not a hacker. But I can find out if someone graduated from a school pretty quickly. And if South Florida, and they said they hired a search firm for this, fire that search firm. How is it that they actually were able to offer him something, he signed the contract, and then all of a sudden they find out, oh, after the fact, that he actually did not graduate from school. The search firm's job should be to find that stuff out before you make the offer and make the deal. But then I heard a good point from, I think, somebody on Twitter, where as far as school transcripts goes, maybe you need the approval of the actual student for it to be given to a search firm or whatever job you're applying to. But still, you would think that there would be some legalese as far as that search firm being able to find out that information. So now South Florida is without a coach. One of the top young coaches in the game is without a job. And then even Manhattan, they're without a coach. He can't go back to Manhattan. He said he was going. He signed off with another team. They've moved on to find their next head coach. Just a really bad situation. Personally, I think he should just take the classes over the summer and just knock that out, and he could still be the coach at South Florida. But I also understand from a public relations view, South Florida cannot have a quote-unquote liar in their top position as far as a head coach. I don't know what direction they're going to go with that, but we've seen it with Eddie Jordan, with Rutgers, when he was trying to get that job. George O'Leary at Central Florida when he was hired at Notre Dame and had some issues with his resume and had that job rescinded from him. It's a new era where you cannot get away with that type of stuff, and these guys need to start realizing that. I delved deeply into what I was watching over the weekend, or this past weekend, with the NCAA basketball tournament. But I spent a lot of time watching the NCAA wrestling championships as well. Penn State won their fourth straight national title. Growing up in the Northeast, I was aware of prep wrestling and even collegiate wrestling. Not as much, of course, as people in the Midwest, where a lot of power programs are. But I knew a few wrestlers because I went to a private school, and I had some friends who actually wrestled with other private schools in the Northeast, in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and so forth. So I'm familiar with the sport. And being a mixed martial arts fan, we've seen so many of collegiate wrestlers transition into the sport. You can't help but notice a fighter going to a certain school and looking back and seeing what they did on a collegiate wrestling level. I was really impressed with what I saw from it. The wrestling championships are in Madison Square Garden in 2016, and I'm already making plans to go to that and see it on the biggest stage. But I said Penn State won. Interested in seeing a lot, you know, Penn State, they're battling Minnesota, Oklahoma State. The championships took place in Oklahoma City, so obviously you had a lot of Oklahoma State fans there. Iowa and Iowa State were trying to represent as well and competing at a national stage. As I said, it's a lot of Big Ten and Big 12 schools, which is not my realm necessarily. But I wanted to acknowledge that I watched the event. I was really intrigued by it. And finally, going to do a new segment on the website called Educating the Babies. This comes from my work at Kennesaw State, and there were some young interns who are currently in college, undergraduate level, and one of them said they never saw Top Gun, and that got the older people, myself included, I'm in my early 30s, older people in the press box were shocked by that someone that was, I think he's 19 or 20, had never seen Top Gun. It was really barely aware of the movie. And what I said to them was that you have to educate the babies. What that means is that you cannot necessarily get mad or shocked at this young generation if they're not aware of some old school stuff. And it's a lot easier now than it's ever been to be aware of this stuff. I guess if you look at my interest and what I watch or listen to, I may be an older soul, because a lot of my stuff may be from like the 80s and 90s. I keep up with current content as well, of course. But with the usage of the internet, I'm on YouTube all day, watching old episodes of shows, new music, and my segment, Educating the Babies, is going to show what my interests are in educating myself and others on what really happened in olden times. Top Gun, honestly, when it first came out, I think in 86 or 87, I mean, I was only 6 or 7 years old. But I saw it through repeats on movie channels, regular television, and on down the line. I've seen it probably a dozen times, but not everyone has that opportunity. So what I'm going to do is educating the babies, put video content up on the site so that the young people out there or younger folks can see some things and learn. And then if you have some suggestions of some old school stuff from the 50s or 60s or, you know, even stuff from 5-6 years ago, you can always contact me through all of my resources. We've gone over it, Facebook, Twitter, email. I forgot to mention that you can go to mportute@gmail.com or sportsinquirer@gmail.com and send me some links and send me some content that we can use in educating the babies. All right, thanks for listening to my show. We're going to wrap it up here. When we come back, probably next week, we're going to go deep into our MLB preview. I have not mentioned baseball at all over the past few episodes, but that's going to change in a big way. Opening week is next week, so we're going to go into my predictions for division winners, World Series teams, and individual awards such as Manager of the Year, MVP, and so forth. We're going to discuss this past weekend, or this upcoming weekend, in NCAA basketball. Our Final Four teams will be set, so we're going to know who is going to be playing in Dallas next weekend. So we're going to delve into that. And then finally, we're going to have an NBA power ranking. I touched on the Hawks quite a bit, and we'll go into Hawks content, of course, but I'm going to expand the scope and discuss the entire NBA as we head towards that playoff push over these next few weeks. So once again, thank you for listening to the show. And since it's in the morning and the sun hasn't risen yet at 7 a.m., I'm going to say good day, good fight, stay safe out there.